I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
And welcome to Radio Times. Soldiers have been writing about war for centuries through journals, letters home, and occasionally writing books about their experiences. In recent years, they've been using email and internet video to stay in touch and to provide a personal take on what it's like to be in the middle of a conflict, the fighting, and the downtime. Now there's a new documentary about war, the first movie made by soldiers on the front line. It's called The War Tapes, and it was filmed by three members of the New Hampshire National Guard. They served with Charlie Company, 3rd Battalion of the 172nd Infantry Regiment, from March 2004 to February 2005. It's graphic, darkly humorous, frank, and at times frightening. It gives viewers a unique perspective on war, including putting the audience in the middle of a firefight. One of those soldiers joins us this morning on Radio Time, Steve Pink. He's worked as a carpenter. He's now working on a book about his experiences in Iraq. He joined the Guard during his second year in college. And Steve Pink, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. And congratulations on this really terrific film.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Robert May. He's the executive producer of The War Tapes. He also produced The Fog of War and The Station Agent. And congratulations and welcome to you, Robert May, as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Steve Pink, let me begin with you. Why did you want to be involved in this project from the get-go?
Well, I think Deborah Scranton came down to Fort Dix. We were getting ready to leave.
She's the director.
She's the director, and you know, it was her idea to, rather than embed with us, to ask for volunteers to take cameras. So she showed up with 10 shiny brand new digital cameras, and it sure looked pretty interesting to me. I mean, I think you know, any new equipment that comes around in the Army is pretty coveted, and certainly a new camera was. But I also thought it was a great opportunity, having done a little bit of journalism beforehand, that, you know, if her intentions were genuine in saying that she wanted to tell our story through our eyes, that, you know, that sounded like something I wanted to be a part of.
What was the reaction of some of your fellow guardsmen? Were they interested in being part of your movie?
Yeah, certainly some of the guys, of course, when the cameras first came, everybody was interested. I mean, whether they were interested in the project or not, they were interested
in
the camera. So, you know, fairly soon after that, it died down. And then, you know, 10 guys started filming, and then 5 guys filmed for the whole year. And the reactions of other guys in the company, some of the guys really loved the camera and would, you know, ham it up, I guess. And then other guys said they, you know, didn't want to be filmed as much and things like that.
Let me turn to you, if I could, Robert May. And what was your interest in this particular project? You've made some other films, including several documentaries as well.
Well, I first met the director at a Sundance producers lab in one summer, and Deborah Scranton was looking for a producer to you know, help pull it all together and, you know, literally create a film.
Right.
And, you know, at first I wasn't interested because, you know, we had done a number of documentaries and we also do narratives as well. But it really was a very compelling subject matter. And I didn't really know anything about the National Guard. And the more she told me about it, the more interested I became, and then agreed to come on and produce it.
And we should say there's something like 1,000 hours worth of footage down to about an hour and a half.
Right. There were 800 hours from Iraq and 200 hours from back home, and literally distilled to 97 minutes.
That's a big job, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, we had a great editor, Steve James, who also directed and edited Hoop Dreams.
Great film as well.
Yes.
Let me turn back to you, Steve Pink. And you joined the Guard in your second year in college. And in this film, you describe it as a rash decision on your part.
Right. I certainly did describe it as a rash decision, I guess. It was my second year at school, and it was either go back to a state school in Massachusetts and live with my parents, or figure out, you know, some other way to stay at the school.
You needed the money, right?
More or less, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the armory was right at the bottom of the hill near my campus, and I said, oh, isn't that convenient? And, you know, I certainly don't regret signing up, and I certainly know that when I did sign, that there was a possibility that, you know, you would go to war. And I could have thought about it a little bit more, maybe, but, you know, also I think somewhere inside of me was thinking, you know, maybe it's time for a test, you know. Mm-hmm. I need to see if, you know, I can accomplish something like this.
You felt like you needed a test because you felt like you hadn't been tested yet as a young person?
I think so. You know, and you know, I grew up a very blue collar family. My father's a cement mason, and my mother's a nurse, and you know, it was you know, to go off to college was a unique experience, and I think that, you know, somewhere along there, the whole work ethic just you know, caught up with me. I said, I need to be doing more than just going to classrooms, you know.
Yours is the first voice that we hear in this film. You say, I want to kill.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you felt like that was your job? That was what you were trained to do, to go to Iraq to kill?
Right, yeah.
And the training, did you feel like the training that you got allowed you to do your job in Iraq?
Well, yeah, absolutely. The thing with our job in the conventional infantry role is to, you know, kill the enemy. Well, it's an extremely difficult thing to do in Iraq with, you know, the way the insurgency really operates, intermixed very well with the civilian population. And also, we were there in kind of a mutated occupational role where it wasn't entirely occupation. You know, a really difficult, constantly changing situation.
And you were based at Camp Anaconda, which was in the Sunni Triangle, or I guess still is in the Sunni Triangle.
Right. I'm not exactly sure what the Sunni Triangle. You know, I think the Sunni Triangle was kind of morphed by the media and developed into this thing, this moniker that, you know, that people say. You know, there are a lot of Sunnis and Shias around, but it was about 25 miles north of Baghdad.
And what was your job when you were there?
Our job consisted half of doing convoy security, convoy missions, escorting, tractor trailer trucks around the country, and the other half for the majority was combat patrols done at a squad level, with, you know, three Humvees, nine guys, and just patrolling different areas.
I wonder, as this you began to look at this footage, Robert May, if you saw something different than the kind of images and videotape that we get back from Iraq, whether it's from journalists or on YouTube or, you know, any of the other ways that we can actually watch what's going on in a war in Iraq.
I think you get the sense that you're seeing, as the soldiers are seeing what they're seeing, you're seeing and experiencing a bit of what they experience. But obviously, there's no way to experience what they've experienced unless you're there with them, literally. But by having the cameras attached to gun turrets and their helmets and all that, you were literally with them through some pretty horrific and funny times as well.
Well, indeed, and there is that, and I'm looking back at you, Steve Pink. I mean, there is that dark humor that we associate with people being in stress or in combat or conflict.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and, you know, especially working and living with the same guys for that amount of time, you're going to have that, you know.
Sure.
And I think it's an important thing that we use really in our daily lives over there.
Seems like you and others had no regard for Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Fair enough?
We were extremely frustrated.
In what way? And I do want to play a clip from the film, but go ahead.
Sure. I mean, you know, in the film you hear, you know, you don't hear one guy going off on a rant about KBR. You hear about six different guys making comments, you know, because we were frustrated, especially, you know, expecting a role that was more along the lines of, you know, patrols and, you know, all the time. But now we were, you know, we were working with 30 tractor trailer trucks, three Humvees. I mean, a convoy that was 2 miles long, carrying all sorts of stuff. You know, fuel. Okay, maybe that's important, but you know, office furniture. You know, how important is that?
And it was your job to protect this convoy,
right? Sure,
as it
sure.
Went in and out of Iraq,
right?
Well, let's play a clip from the film, and we are talking with Steve Pink and Robert May. They've put together a film called The War Tapes, and it's about the experiences of three members of the National Guard from New Hampshire and their experiences in Iraq more than a year ago. Let's listen.
KBR annoys me. I don't want to talk politics, but man, they got it good. Take every store in your town, every gas station, police department, fire department, and let it all be run by one company. I mean, that's basically what they do. They have their hands in anything you can think of. KBR runs all our chow halls.
Today we're having Middle Eastern Swedish meatballs and Iraqi freedom fries.
Look at all these plates, huh?
To charge the military food, they're going to put out 4,000 plates times $28 a plate. So when people take two, because sometimes we take one and then we'll take one and put it on top to keep it warm, it's $56 KBR just charged the government.
And is that true? $28 a plate?
I can't verify that. That's definitely a rumor that that was going around. And in watching some of the other ways that Halliburton had dealt with things, it was certainly not. We didn't doubt that it could possibly be true. You know?
Do you think of this Robert May as a political film with a point of view?
I think it's organically political. I mean, life is political, and I think it's organically political. I think this is an example of real experience without a specific cause or order. I mean, this film wasn't put together to support a specific side or cause, but this is real life. This is what they experienced, and obviously Steve can attest to that more than I can, but the intention was to literally tell their story as it unfolded.
And to not take a position
exactly
per se
right.
on the war,
right.
pro or con.
Right. And
go ahead, Steve.
I think this is the best example of this, the Halliburton topic in the film, because every time I watch it, I'm looking for this editorial comment from Robert and Deborah and Steve and everyone. I'm really looking for them to, have made it theirs, but they haven't at all. And I guess the KBR topic here is the perfect example of how they haven't done that. I mean, if it was one guy on this, 5-minute rant about KBR, that would be one thing. But it's not. You get, five or six small statements from five or six different guys. So obviously it was something that we were concerned about and is an important part of the story. So that's why it's in there.
Well, and there's also a piece where some of the drivers come from third world countries. And,
sure.
and I'm not sure whether it's you or someone in the film is really horrified that they don't get the same kind of protection that other drivers would get.
Right. Yeah. I had mentioned that and was able to get some footage of that because America where KBR was paying these truck drivers Americans about $120,000 a year with 2 weeks vacation every 3 to 4 months anywhere in the world. So these guys, who wouldn't take that really? A truck driver here that's making $30,000
sure.
has this chance. But then they all started getting killed, so they didn't want to work there anymore. The money wasn't as important. So then it was like, well, why don't we hire these third country nationals? And it's almost like, why didn't they do that in the first place? You're surprised that they didn't do that in the first place.
Mm.
So then things got even worse with the convoys because now no one speaks English. No one has the proper equipment maintenance, and there's still 30 of them.
And you were not obviously paid $120,000 to be in Iraq either. Was there resentment about just the pay for the kind of work that you were doing?
No, because generally the pay. I thought it was pretty good, because you're not spending any money while you're there, really, and the pay wasn't bad. I didn't think.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're up in a break, and I do want to get back to our conversation and get the director of this film in on the conversation as well. And we're talking about a new documentary opens today. It's called The War Tapes, and it's a film by three reservists from the New Hampshire National Guard who served in Iraq from March 2004 to February 2005. We're talking with one of the soldiers, Steve Pink, and he's now working on a book about his experiences in Iraq. Also with us is Robert May, executive producer of The War Tapes. He also produced The Fog of War and The Station Agent. And we'll be joined by Deborah Scranton after this short break, and she's the director of The War Tapes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This week on American Roots, we'll commemorate the first anniversary of the greatest natural and cultural disaster in U.S. history, the storm and flood of 2005. There's live music and conversation from Wynton Marsalis, and post-flood voices and music from the year after. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRI.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
We know that a lot of people are intimidated by car repair.
So we always try to avoid jargon and answer questions in human terms.
But if your injectors are tired and old and worn out, they will leak when they're not supposed to. And what happens is...
They're like my brother.
We're Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers. For down-to-earth advice, join us for Car Talk.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Why do kids have homework? One author says they don't need it. Also, a singer-songwriter who's getting much acclaim from her musical peers. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new documentary called The War Tapes, and it was filmed by some reservists from the New Hampshire National Guard who served in Iraq from March 2004 to February 2005. It won the Best International Documentary Competition at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it opens in theaters today. And Steve Pink, one of the cameraman soldiers with us here in our Philadelphia studios, Robert May, the executive producer. And joining us by telephone is Deborah Scranton. She's the director of The War Tapes. And Deborah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations to you as well.
Oh, well, thank you. It's lovely to be here with you. Well, but I do have to just say, Robert's the producer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I
have to clarify, Robert May, you know, this film would never have been made without him, and I just have to feel like I have to say he is the producer.
I hear you. Well, to you, Deborah Scranton, I know you were asked actually by the National Guard in New Hampshire to embed it as a filmmaker, but you wanted to do something different, which is what this documentary is all about. Why were you interested in approaching the war from that perspective?
I thought that it would give a more authentic view. I think there's something very profound about soldiers themselves actually pressing record.
I'm sorry, what is that?
I think there's something profound itself about soldiers being the ones to press the record button on a camera.
And I'm sorry, I did not hear everything that you said there. But what do you get from that you don't get from, let's say, a journalist who's living in Baghdad?
Well, a lot of people would say journalists living in Baghdad don't see the war. I think by having soldiers themselves tell their stories and be the ones to press record, it's a whole different experience and a journey in authenticity.
I know you went down to Fort Dix to talk to some of these soldiers to see who was interested in this project. What was the pitch that you made to them?
I gave them a promise. I said my vision was to tell the story through their eyes, wherever it took us, no matter what. And of the 180 soldiers in Charlie Company 3rd of the 172nd Mountain Infantry, 10 soldiers stepped forward. And of those 10, 5 filmed the entire year.
Wow. And I know you were asked a lot of questions from the soldiers. What did they want to know about you?
They wanted to know why they should trust me. They wanted to know what I knew about the New Hampshire National Guard and the National Guard in general. They wanted to know how could they know that I wouldn't take their words and twist them.
And you were able to allay any concerns that they might have?
Well, I should hope so, although maybe Steve might speak to it.
I'm looking at
Steve. Is there. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Deborah.
You want to add to that, Steve?
Well, yeah, sure. Of course, I was very leery early on. You know, I had no idea who this woman was, or Chuck Lacey, who came down there with her, and was very skeptical. I had no idea, and in no way. I mean, sure, she could say her intentions were great, but I really needed, you know, some proof and, you know, to see that she was going to genuinely do what she said. And it took a couple months, really, although I was filming the whole time. But, in communicating with Deborah, in understanding, because, we sent some emails back and forth throughout the course of the year. And she would send questions, and I really wouldn't answer them, and I would just send my own questions back to her. and, you know, after a time after that, it started to work out, and I did end up trusting her. Yeah.
Well, you know, Deborah,
we earned each other's trust, I think, you know, every day. I think that is what true trust is based on, is showing up and being there for each other and not wavering in your belief in the other. It's a testament to friendship as well.
Well, you know, I'm fascinated by this whole project and the fact that you had something like 1,000 hours. Were you sort of editing as you were getting tapes? And I'm sure the internet was a great way to stay in touch and to watch what some of these soldier filmmakers were doing.
Yeah, well, that's sort of a two-pronged question. We had two brilliant editors, Steve James and Leslie Simmer, who are both based in Chicago, who edited the film. We started editing almost when the soldiers were on their way back here. Right. What the internet allowed us to do was to talk, the soldiers and I, as events happened. Like, for me, vividly, Steve, one of the things I remember most was getting an email from you after that double V bed at Taji, you know, with that's in the film, and obviously you had spent a long day trying to save a lot of Iraqi lives.
You want to talk about that, Steve?
Sure. I mean, I think for me, when that incident occurred, it really kind of changed the whole project to me, and really let me understand that we were doing a pretty important thing here with these cameras, because CNN had broadcast their version of the story, what happened that day, and it was grossly incorrect for the most part, and that's when I really realized that we were doing something with these cameras that no one else was able to do and that no one else had seen before.
At one point in the film, Steve, you say you lost all faith in the media.
Sure, yeah.
Because what, they didn't see what you saw? They called things differently from what you observed?
Right, and of course it's a very difficult job for them over there. And, you know, first of all, if they get the story right is one thing, and then deciding how to tell it and from what angle is a complete another thing. And there's plenty of stuff that they could be reporting on differently. Or
were there reporters embedded with your group? Did you see reporters out in the field?
I saw one guy, like, right after a firefight with an NBC vest on, just kind of scamper across the street. And for the most part, we stayed away from any reporters.
Let me turn to you, if I could, Robert May, only because you produced The Fog of War, another great documentary, I must say. But as I was watching this, I was thinking about that documentary, which is about Robert McNamara, and he talks about the Vietnam War and talks about the fact that in the fog of war, the people running the war often don't know what's going on the ground. And I wonder, as you looked at this material, how you saw some of the connections between these two films.
Well, I think there are a number of connections. I think that when you're making these tactical decisions from an office, and you're basing it on analysis and statistics and so forth, you're not necessarily paying as close attention to the lives, the breathing souls that are on the front line that have to execute whatever the mission is. And so a mistake made in a war control room is moved on the next day, and to try to avoid that. But the mistake that maybe is executed because of that planning, literally out in the field, can cost lives.
Do you see, though, the fog of war in a way in this film?
Absolutely. I do. Yes, I do.
Where you've got soldiers sort of trying to figure out what's going on, especially with an insurgent war.
Well, I think that one of the things that I've learned about war for both of these films is how complex war really is, and how it's not just such a simple point of view. And that some of the most brilliant minds of our time, including Robert McNamara, still couldn't figure out exactly how to, first of all, alleviate or avoid war, and also how to fight maybe the best war. And they still made mistakes. Some of the most brilliant minds still made mistakes and cost hundreds of thousands of lives, particularly in World War II and Vietnam and so forth.
And that's
less so in this war, but plenty of suffering nevertheless.
And that's Robert May. He's the producer of The War Tapes, a new documentary that opens today. Also with us by telephone is Deborah Scranton. She's the director of The War Tapes. And also with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Steven Pink, one of the soldiers who provided footage and commentary for the film. And he joined the National Guard to help pay for college. He's working on a book about his experiences in Iraq. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. To you, Deborah Scranton, I'm curious whether the National Guard or the military had any kind of controls over where these soldiers could go, what they could film, what you could look at?
Well, they had control over where the soldiers went, in the sense that they were giving the soldiers the missions as far as where they would go. The arrangement was the soldiers would film the tapes, they would turn them into their company commander, who had the option to review them, who then could send the tapes on to the public affairs officer in New Hampshire, and then they were delivered to me.
And it sounds like the way you've talked about this film is that you had largely full cooperation from the National Guard in New Hampshire.
Absolutely. No, they called me with the offer to embed. So, yes, my experience with the military has been only that of where they want the soldiers' stories to get out, for us to each know that these are our neighbors fighting in our name in this war. We are a country at war.
Steve Pink, there's one scene in this film where it looks like you're back home, actually, talking about a firefight where you come across bodies of Iraqis that have been killed. And this is a scene that actually was edited out, but you talk about it. I wonder if you could talk about it on the radio.
Well, they weren't Iraqis. I mean, they were, I guess, what we would call the insurgents. You know, I mean, they definitely tried to kill guys in my platoon and another squad. Shot Sergeant Smith, who's still recovering from injuries today. After we continued, we showed up right after the firefight happened and had to keep an eye on the bodies until the tow tagger showed up. So after we secured the area and were securing the bodies, I decided it was an appropriate time to take the camera out and did so. Scanned the bodies, had some few choice words for them, and turned the tape in like I did every other tape. And I think it had something to do with respect for the dead or something like that. Is why it didn't get through. But, you know, I saw it as that's why the chain of command existed, really. That's why we sent the tapes in the way we did. And they had the, you know, the chance and opportunity not to send it on. And, you know, I think they made a good decision in not sending it on.
And the story was still told. I mean,
I was going to get to that. Yeah, go ahead, Deborah.
No, I'm sorry. It's just, you know, Steve still ended up telling the story, and I agree with what he said. I think it's important to focus on the fact that the military let 800 hours of tape through, and this was the one tape they held back.
Well, and I'm not criticizing anybody for that. I'm interested in the way that you were able to include this as part of the documentary, allowing Steve, obviously, to talk about what he saw. And Deborah, you did include, it looks like, some photographs of these bodies, yes?
Yes, which we got anonymously, yes.
And able to and why was it important to have this as part of the story, Deborah?
Because it was a very definitive experience of Steve's experience in Iraq.
You agree with that, Steve?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because it was...
Well, because, you know, we had spent at that point probably around, you know, 9 or 10 months fighting against these guys who were really extremely elusive and very difficult to get a hold of. And the tactics that they use with a... You know, as effective as they are, they have a complete disregard for human life, for the civilians there. So it makes it extremely difficult to respect them as an enemy. So finally, you know, seeing them face to face and dead was, you know, I don't want to say uplifting, but it's pretty close to that, really, in seeing that, okay, now maybe this is the mission that we're trying to accomplish here.
I must say, when there were scenes of you and some of the other soldiers out on the street talking to Iraqis, sometimes buying things from Iraqis, talking to kids as well, and only because we know about this level of insurgent violence, I had a sense of great anxiety. Obviously, you made it, but trying to imagine what it would be like on the street talking to kids and obviously having to look very carefully at your surroundings to see exactly what's going on.
Right. I mean, that's exactly what you do. Your training and, situational awareness is absolutely essential when you're in Iraq. And, and you need to maintain that every day for a year. And if you don't, then, that's how people get killed.
And learning to spot if an IED is on the road or if there are suspicious-looking people.
Right. I mean, it's extremely difficult. And, they do train you early on to look for possible IEDs and things like that. But, It's an incredibly effective method that they use.
I wonder back to you, Deborah Scranton, and we were talking earlier about the perspective of this particular film, and I asked Robert May if he thought it was a political film, and he had his answer. I'm curious how you see this film.
I think it's political in the best sense of the term, in that it stimulates discussion. You know, we're a country at war. I think it's important we know what war looks like, feels like, smells like all around. There's 140,000 boots on the ground, not counting special forces, because we don't have their numbers, you know, in our name. What does that mean?
And do you stay in contact with the soldiers that have been involved in this particular project?
Yes, we do. We talk.
And talk about the war and talk about their experiences and talk about the making of this documentary?
No, at this point, I mean, we're friends. You know, we became friends through the process. So it's more like Hey, Steve. Hi. How's the beach today?
And I should add to you, Deborah Scranton, too, what's also included in the film are the families of these soldiers that are in Iraq.
And, a wife, a mother, and a girlfriend. Which they're the hidden heroes. We very rarely hear their story. Mm-hmm. It's a very important story. And Steve's lovely girlfriend, Lindsay, is, you know, at Q&As nationwide. She's one of the favorites.
Well, and I can see why, because she's very honest and very direct. And you see for each of these people what it's like to have someone in Iraq and the kind of anxiety that they have on a day-to-day basis. Were they open to being part of this project as well, Deborah?
Yes, I went to every family potluck throughout the year, which they had monthly. And Lindsay, I should say, didn't go because there's this weird divide between if you're a wife or a girlfriend. And as a girlfriend, not a lot of them end up going. But I think it's really important when you're trying to understand the soldier experience that you look at the loved ones they're entwined with, better understand what that experience is.
And I wonder what it was like for you, Steve, to hear your girlfriend talk about you and your relationship.
Right. Well, it was, I guess, very educational the first time I saw it because, you know, I certainly wasn't telling her what I was doing every day, and she was really doing the best she could to be strong, and you know, while I was gone, and when we both saw it together for the first time, it really helped a lot because you know, we were able to kind of see what each other went through without having to go through the struggle, I guess, of starting at the very beginning of it and try to explain to each other some things that are, you know, really inexplicable for the most part.
Well, and what she seemed to say, and it looks like this is the way you also carried yourself, was that you wrote a lot. I mean, that was your way of expressing what you were going through when you were in Iraq.
She has boxes of letters, Steve.
Boxes of letters.
May not confess, but she does have boxes of letters. She's a very lucky girl to have.
To have all those letters.
Heavy letters.
Indeed.
Steven.
Right. I mean, we had the opportunity to email, you know, back and forth on occasion, but for some reason to me, that just didn't seem as intimate as it needed to be. So we wrote letters.
And you wrote every day, once a week, when you could?
When I could, yeah.
And did you find that there was a way for you to put on
paper? Lindsay said it was pretty much every day, Steve.
you're part of the truth squad here, right, Deborah Scranton? But you found letters better than email.
Oh, absolutely.
Something about, what, the pen in the hand or just...
Yeah, certainly. The fact that it's tangible, you can have it. I mean, what are you going to do? Your email box gets full and you print it out and now you have this printed out, you know, letters. It doesn't...
It's a different kind of aesthetic, right?
Right, right.
Deborah Scranton, this is your first feature film, is that right?
The first theatrical one, yes. Yeah. I had done an earlier one on World War II veterans called Stories from Silence, Witness to War that aired on local PBS station. But yes, my first feature theatrical.
That's great. And you're obviously interested in war, yes?
Well, I think it's one of the oldest stories in the world. It's the hero's journey. It's the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know? I think as human beings, we all go on life's journeys. We all fight our battles, and we all try to make our way home. I think there's stories we can all relate to and learn from.
Indeed. Well, I thank you so much. And again, congratulations on your film.
Oh, thank you so much for having us on. We really, really appreciate it.
That's great. And that's Deborah Scranton, director of The War Tapes, and joined us by telephone from her home up in New England. And we are talking about The War Tapes. It's a new documentary made by three reservists from the New Hampshire National Guard who served in Iraq from March 2004 to February 2005. We will continue our conversation with the producer of The War Tapes, Robert May, and Stephen Pink, one of the soldiers. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia moves forward to the next mayoral election. How will surrounding areas be affected? What issues concern the entire region? How will the future of Philadelphia help determine the future of the entire Delaware Valley? The next mayor. A groundbreaking multimedia project to explore the issues leading to the Philadelphia mayoral election. Your Issues, Your Voice. Presented by WHYY, The Daily News, and the Committee of 70. To learn more, visit thenextmayor.org.
The Emmy Awards will be given Sunday night. The medical series House is nominated for 4 Emmys. On The Next Fresh Air, we talk with David Shore, the creator of House, and David Foster, a doctor who has worked as a consultant and writer for the program. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for The Next Fresh Air. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Between Morning Edition
and All Things Considered,
we bring you Day to Day.
News, interviews.
If they get to me and they kill me, I can always leave something behind.
And features you won't hear anywhere else.
It's good radio in the middle of the day.
Day to Day from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The War Tapes is said to be the first war movie that was filmed by soldiers on the front line. Cameramen from the New Hampshire National Guard were given cameras and went to Iraq. They were there from March 2004 to February 2005. The War Tapes won the Best International Documentary Competition at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York City earlier this year. It opens in theaters today, and we're talking with one of the filmmaker soldiers, Steve Pink, and Robert May, the producer of the War Tapes. And we just said goodbye to the director, Deborah Scranton. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Steve, I do want to play another clip from the film. And as we learned, you wrote a lot during this film. And this is a scene where you're really writing about something that had happened. And I wonder if you could just set this up for us. What are you writing about in this particular scene?
Right. I think it's one where I was writing about a discussion that we all had earlier that day about the texture and description, really, of different body parts for the most part. And just as I'm writing and kind of realizing that, you know, this isn't something that I'm making up. This is a discussion that we had. This is like reporting almost, you know, a discussion that we had that day. And, you know, just kind of take a step back and see that that's something you're doing every day.
Yeah, let's listen.
Every once in a while, as we're driving down the road, creeping along on patrol, I have a reoccurring epiphany. This is happening and will have a lasting impact on me for the rest of my life. The debate we had earlier in the day over the consistency and texture of a severed limb was not some far-off grotesque assumption. It was a genuine argument between the guy who swears it resembles hamburger, ground up but uncooked, and the guy who believe it looks more like a raw pot roast. There is no argument, however, that human intestines are pink pork sausage links. If, of course, you imagine a butcher's block as the background instead of the screaming, then soon quietly moaning casualty.
And again, another scene from the War Tapes. And back to you, Robert May. I mean, this is, I think, just a little example of just the directness, the frankness, the honesty, the graphic nature of this particular film.
It was, and there were many of those moments, actually. And, you know, the way that the tapes came through, they came through our office in New York, and so we would have people logging them and duplicating them there before we sent them off to the editor. So, you know, I had an opportunity to sit and just check in. So I'd walk into our little office and check, and then I found myself an hour later still staring at some of the footage that was coming back and realizing just how unbelievable it was, and, you know, and feeling also how important it was to tell the story as well.
Do documentary films still have to fight, to get attention?
They do, because audiences, first of all, don't want to be so much educated by, you know, seeing a film in theaters, but entertained. And in this kind of a film, you know, you have to, you know, it's this cross between, you know, sort of entertainment, education, and sort of an obligation to understand, let's say, what war is about. And, you know, but yet the humor of life is still present in this film. And so documentaries that have a character arc, more narrative in nature, I think are more interesting for audiences to see, as opposed to journalistic documentary. And this is very much a character-driven narrative documentary.
In fact, there were more soldiers who were filming, but the idea, I guess, was to really focus on three soldiers, and that way you could actually tell their stories and weave them together.
Right, because it was always the intention to literally have this character, you know, show the character of these men and have that narrative flow, very similar to a fiction film. But this really happened. It's real.
Yeah. I got the impression, and you can correct me, Steve, if I'm incorrect here, but I got the impression, at least from the three soldiers that we meet in this film, is you became more bitter as the war went on, as your time went on in Iraq. More disillusioned?
I wouldn't say disillusioned. Bitter is a little bit closer, I guess. Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's going to wear on you for, you know, being there for an entire year. And you really start to see things, you know, from the boots on the ground perspective. Like, this is the end result of the policies that, that, you know, this country's made. It's a look right at it. So certainly your opinions change, I guess, a little bit. And, you know, you become more educated, I guess, in what's happening every day.
But did you question then your year in Iraq, why you were there?
Well, I kind of came up with this thought that it was kind of a moot point and a bad idea to really question why we were there while we were there. You know, I just thought that was a little dangerous. You know, I didn't want to be, you know, talking politics the whole time when it was kind of a moot point. We were there and it didn't matter, you know. And then I guess if you're lucky enough to come home, then you can debate and, you know, enjoy the freedom of speech in this country all you want.
In that clip that we played, you talk about this is going to have a lasting effect on you. I mean, in what way are you – do you think you're a different person today than you were before you went?
Well, maybe a little bit. I mean, of course, I'm very grateful for the things that we enjoy in this country. Also, you know, understand that there's some things that you experience in war that are going to stay with you for the rest of your lives, you know, for good, for better or worse.
Does that mean you had to sort of – figure out how to be a civilian once you got back?
Oh, absolutely.
How to live that civilian life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even as a civilian soldier, as National Guard, you still just, you know, spend a year in a place where your actions depended on your daily survival every day, and all of the domestic stuff that kind of goes on with your civilian life is way on the back burner. And then you get home, and those things completely swap out, and now, you know, what mattered every day in Iraq is now not as important at all. And The stuff that was extremely trivial while you're in Iraq is now the most important things you have to deal with every day.
And your girlfriend talks about, you know, you when you first come back, and I mean, she thinks you're having a hard time sleeping, you're having a hard time sort of readjusting to life in the U.S.
Right, and I think that's something, you know, that's very common among among combat troops that come back from a war. After time, things start to readjust, you know, but that definitely takes time.
And does this film help only because, it's forced you into a conversation over the last couple of years?
Right. It has a little bit, and, it does help a little bit, but also I think it helps other soldiers and their families, you know, and I was pretty candid at the end of the film there, and if in doing that it's going to help other people, then I think it's important.
You had mentioned that, I guess, in the downtime in Iraq, you don't want to think about, you know, the sort of political discussions that you might have back stateside. But what did you do during downtime, and how do you sort of manage the time off the convoys and off the streets?
Well, the first thing you do is you maintain your equipment and things like that. And, you know, once that's taken care of, there is downtime. And I think it was Michael Hare who said something along the lines that nobody builds a base like America, you know. so the development on the bases in Iraq is up there. You can go swimming, you can watch a movie at almost every major post in Iraq. You can eat Burger King, you can go buy a DVD and watch it on your laptop. So it's for a lot of guys, a fairly comfortable war in the rear, you know. And then it just makes the drastic differences that much more evident
when you're out on the street.
Right.
Yeah. Let me get Ellen from Fort Washington to join us this morning on Radio Times. Ellen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I am the mother of a U.S. Marine who's 22, and I just really wanted to thank these people for making this film. My son is gearing up for his second deployment in October. And I just feel that this war has been sanitized for the American people. And I very much thank these people for doing this documentary. I wish it was required of every citizen to watch it. I haven't seen it yet, but from what I can hear, it's just a message that needs to be out. And I feel so frustrated that on a daily basis, people don't realize we are at war. And it's a very painful experience for me. But I really appreciate the work that these people are doing.
Well, I certainly appreciate your call and certainly your son's service as well. Ellen, have you been able to talk to him in the time that he's been back from Iraq and have some of the conversations that we've been talking about on the radio?
A bit, but I think where he is right now, he can't really get in touch with some of the feelings that they're talking about.
Because
he's there to do a job. He can't think. He just has to go and do, and hopefully when he's finished, he'll be able to do this.
Yeah.
But he can't do it now.
But he can't do it because he's getting ready to go back to Iraq.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's in there to do a job, and he doesn't think politics. I think he's very fearful about going back again. Mm. I'm very fearful.
Sure.
But this is the reality of the situation, and you know, when I look at what's on in the front page of the newspaper, and when it's things JonBenet Ramsey, or you know, our culture just gets hung up in so many different areas. When to me, this is so critical,
right.
And it's happening every day, and it affects the military and their families, and so many other people can just turn it off.
Well, you know, I have to say, it looks like both of my guests want to respond to your call. Ellen, thanks for calling into the show. Steve Pink, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that was a great comment that she had just made about the JonBenet Ramsey case. And, you know, I've been noticing that, too. And then again, you know, when the war with Hezbollah and Israel broke out, Iraq immediately went to the back burner. And certainly Afghanistan has been on the media's back burner for a couple of years now. And there were definitely important things, you know, going on that need to be, need to show up in on our TV screen so that we can absorb something that's, you know, a little more defined and a little more correct in the reporting of the war.
But I'm curious from your experience back in the States whether you do get the impression that the United States or a lot of the people don't know that we're at war.
Sure. I think that unless you serve or know someone that served, it's very easy to make this war, at most, a political debate, a political discussion, and at the least, to completely... you know, be able to go on with life without having any idea that we're at war.
And Robert May, she talked about how war, the images of war are sanitized so much. You want to speak to that?
Well, I think that's true. First of all, I think that journalists are much more protected than the soldiers themselves. I mean, they are, you know, the soldiers and National Guardsmen in this particular film, you know, they're there. I mean, they're literally on the front line. They're not a step behind. And so you see what they see. But I think one of the points I think that the caller made that I think was really important to note is that we've been told by family members who've seen this film that it actually provides a method for them to be able to talk to their loved ones who have actually fought war, and that's been true of frankly a number of the commanders in the National Guard who had seen the film who had. Their particular commander had his son was in the National Guard around the same time that was being filmed. His son came back from Iraq and just could not talk about the experience. Mm-hmm. And he came up to us afterwards and he said, you know, I think that this allows me to really open up a dialogue with my son about what he experienced there. And that is what a number of family members who've seen the film have been telling us.
Let me turn back to you, Steve Pink. And one of the impressions that I got from watching the film was the sort of combination of both mistrust and dislike of Iraqi people on the street from the soldiers.
Right. Well, we have no idea what their culture is like, and they really have no idea what our culture is like. And, you know, certainly there's a little bit more room for some cultural awareness training before going to Iraq, not to make everything happy between the two of us, but really to help to know your enemy better and to try and get an idea of the way they think. I mean, that's why I think we should have this training, and then, you know, better relations with Iraqi civilians could be kind of a subsequent, you know, reaction to that, kind of like the whole idea about bringing democracy.
But were you frustrated because you didn't speak the language? Now, one of the soldiers does speak the language in this film, but you didn't.
Right. No, I didn't. And we had to rely on interpreters who were few and far between. You know, I really noticed that the Iraqi civilians, their opinion of us kind of wavered every day because one day we could be at a school dropping off all kinds of supplies, doing, you know, incredible humanitarian aid effort. And the next day, we have to set up a checkpoint, you know, near the same neighborhood. And now, you know, this guy's 4 hours late getting to work, or, you know, something even worse happens. You know, and they're constantly getting searched and things. And it's something we have to do, but it's also something that I think is really starting to wear on the Iraqi civilians.
The sort of day-to-day anxiety about your mission there, but also the relationship with the people and
right.
the effect of that mission
right.
on the people.
Right.
You have another film that you're working on, a very different kind of film, and I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's called Bonneville, and it's a road trip movie with three mid-50-year-old women played by Jessica Lange, Kathy Bates, and Joan Allen, who traveled from Pocatello, Idaho, to Santa Barbara in a 1965 Bonneville convertible, delivering the ashes of one of the women's recently deceased husbands to her wicked stepdaughter.
Well, that's a switch for you.
Yeah, in fact, the publicist for that movie, you know, after who also worked on the war tape, said, you know, like, so on the war tapes, you have this very manly oriented film, and then on the other hand, you have this like chick flick.
So nice sort of break from some of the tough stuff of
it's
a documentary.
It's all about story, though.
It's all about story. We had a call, Steve Rigg. We're almost out of time here. We had a call from a mom whose son, a Marine, is going back to Iraq. Is that something that weighs on you?
A little bit, sure. I'm on what's called the inactive ready reserve status right now, where I'm not required to put a uniform on, but I still owe the military about a year and a half. And I guess the other day in the news, some Marines have been called off that list themselves. It's a possibility.
So it puts you in kind of in a limbo land, doesn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. A little purgatory, I guess.
A little purgatory. Well, again, I thank you, both of you, for joining us today on Radio Times, and congratulations on the film.
Thanks. Thank you.
A lot.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And we've been talking with Steve Pink and Robert May about the new film, and it's called The War Tapes, a documentary made by a reservist from the New Hampshire National Guard who served in Iraq, and that was from March 2004 to February 2005. The film actually won the Best International Documentary Competition at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it opens today. Steve Pink, one of those soldiers, he's working on a book about his experiences in Iraq. Robert May, the producer of The War Tapes, he also produced The Fog of War and The Station Agent. And earlier in the hour, we heard from Deborah Scranton, the director of The War Tapes. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moscoane. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.